Imagine what the setting was. You are seeing two small creatures moving across a very flat, open area with a smoking volcano in the background.
From KCRW, this is Here Be Monsters. And before we start the show, I just want to let you know that we have a new poster, a meat poster, for sale now on our website, hbmpodcast.com/store. Okay, that's it. Back to the volcano.
It has just, the volcano has just puffed a layer of ash over the landscape. It's just rained. And these two creatures, who are really arboreal, tree-oriented creatures, are in this landscape in which they're very vulnerable. They don't have big canine teeth. They can't run particularly fast. They're really vulnerable where they are, and they're looking around, and they're apprehensive. And they're walking through this slush, leaving two parallel sets of tracks. And we know there was a big one and a small one because one set of tracks is big and one set of tracks is small. We also know that those two tracks were incredibly close together, so close that their bodies must have been virtually touching. And we know that they were walking together at the same time because they're walking in step. So the closeness of these two, why were they so close? What could they possibly have been doing? Were they carrying something? Were they holding hands? And in the end, we decided that this scene with the arm of one draped over the other was the least loaded possible scenario that we could have come up with to account for these animals being so close together and walking side by side. We were showing a vignette in time.
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
the kindergartner's finger paint masterpiece.
The podcast about
the unknown.
I'm at work. I'm a welder, fabricator, sheet metal, tin bender. I was welding up a curb adapter there in the beginning of this recording. I was thinking about your question for the last couple of weeks, actually, about archaeologists. And it made me think about 3 million years ago were some of the first hominids walking around the earth. Or so they thought, until recently when they dug up even older hominids walking around. So it makes me wonder what kind of evolution that we've gotten ourselves growing into, if you know what I mean. Do you think that the human body will be different? Will we have extra appendages? Will we even have to communicate through talking at that point? Or will it all be psychic communication? I mean, if evolution has taken us from basically a hominid monkey fascinated by such simple things like the lizard walking around, it makes you wonder, where will evolution take us?
It was April. And I woke up in New York City. It's a place that always feels strange to me, but this day, it felt stranger. It was a Sunday, approximately 1,643,589,900,106 days from the birth of the planet, give or take. It was 5,777 Nisan 20 on the Hebrew calendar, 1,396 Farvardin 27 on the Persian. My phone thought it was 1,492,333,200, measured in seconds from the beginning of the Unix epoch, Personally, I thought it was 9 a.m. on the 16th of April, 2017. But that was just me, so I put on my shoes. I went to the American Museum of Natural History. I underpaid the suggested donation. The halls there were crowded with children, and under a giant dinosaur skeleton, I watched a young couple get married. I looked at rocks. I watched an old couple walk slowly together. There was a globe of the moon that I touched, made out of a yellow metal that had been polished by many hands. And then I saw something different. It was two full-grown people, just 3 feet tall, covered in hair and completely naked, perfectly frozen, caught in mid-stride, protected by plexiglass. Outside the enclosure, kindergartners of the same size ran and screamed. Adults called after them, looking at their phones while they walked. Inside the plexiglass, the big one held the little one. It was like a time machine, plopped into the present from the distant past, and I couldn't tell whether the two looked curious or scared. On a normal day, I would have seen these two figures for what they were. Plasticine, with a rubber skin and hand-stitched fur. But I'd woken up that Sunday feeling a little bit foggy, a little bit slow. And that let me see these two early humans a little bit differently. It was like, those people. They're a part of me somehow. I can see it in their eyes.
Well, it's very interesting that you should have had your particular reaction to those figures. The look of surprise or apprehension that you saw on their faces was deliberately put there by the sculptor to try to capture the kind of nervousness and apprehension that two little creatures would be having or feeling in this really unusual environment. Most of the times, these early hominids would have lived in or around the trees, which would have afforded them a certain amount of protection. They did not have that in the open environment. And I'm glad you caught the brilliance of this piece of sculptural work in which the artist, John Holmes, captured this sort of sense of wariness and quasi-fear that these creatures must have felt. This really is the area where art does meet science. You could not do a reliable reconstruction of an ancient human being or a dinosaur or an extinct mammal without the science, and you certainly couldn't do it without the art. And this is where the two really intersect in a very meaningful way.
Those two early humans, they're called the Laetoli figures, named for the region of modern-day Tanzania where the volcanic footprints were found. Figures made in the early 1990s by a British artist named John Holmes, constructed to represent two members of Australopithecus afarensis, same species as the famous fossil of Lucy. It was 3 million years ago. They wandered the Earth upright, with a brain barely bigger than that of a modern monkey. They probably hadn't figured out stone tools, definitely hadn't figured out fire. I emailed Ian Tattersall. He's the paleontologist who directed the construction of the Laetoli figures. I took another trip to New York, and I met him in an office full of reconstructed heads of early hominids.
But I think it was done after John Holmes did his.
This looks Neanderthal to me, is that right?
Yeah, that's Neanderthal. Actually, that is based on a pre-Neanderthal from Spain. But this is particularly instructive because it shows you how the musculature is laid on.
So when you're tasked with something where you have just fragments of a skull in this case, and you have to make something for the museum that is a complete creature, what do you use to fill in those areas that you don't understand?
Now, that's an extremely important consideration. You know, when you're making a museum exhibit, you're trying to basically create an illusion. And to work at all, the illusion has to be complete. And so you have to have all the details in there. And, you know, the average person doesn't really relate to the bony skeleton. Of course, we relate to the fully fleshed out creature. So you have to apply the flesh to the bones in some way. You know, as a scientist, you'd rather deal with things you're certain about. But there are some things that we can't know, right? There are some things that we can't know, such as, for sure, such as many of these superficial details of anatomy that do not imprint themselves directly on the skeleton. And that you have to recreate based on your best estimate of what was going on. And as a scientist, you don't want to do this. I mean, as a scientist, I am not really interested in flesh reconstructions because I live in a world of bones, and the bones are what the actual evidence is, and the bones are what I relate to and what speak to me. Yeah, I think many of us would rather not be doing this, but if you're a museum scientist, it's part of what you have to do. And, you know, nobody is claiming that any of the renditions that we make today are definitive versions of what that actually was out there. It's just our best guess. 25 years ago, when those figures that we have downstairs were made, we generally believed that these early hominids were rather more human-like than we believe today. And of course, we wouldn't do the same thing today as we did a quarter of a century ago, because we are learning things all the time. You know, science is a work in progress.
Assuming most of the written and digital record has been lost, and perhaps these archaeologists 3 million years in the future are coming back to Earth from planets many light years away, I'd like to think that just one thing that they could never know is this. These distant future humanoid archaeologists might find bottles that once contained paint. Now, this would tell an archaeologist that the people who use these may have had a certain reverence for art and for painting. However, what we could never know is exactly what that paint created. Was it works of art like those found in our museums? A kindergartner's finger paint masterpiece? Or perhaps it was the dreams and images in the mind of a creative spirit who paints pictures because she loves to do it, but always gives them away to her family and friends because she doesn't want to stare at them any longer because she'll eventually destroy it with layers and layers of touch-ups. Archaeologists would never know what these paintings were of, not 3 million years from now. What type of mood they conveyed? Were they beautiful or were they ugly? What type of style did this artist have? Was she even an artist at all? Would she consider herself an artist? Would others? I think that there are always more questions raised than are answered by any discovery or any artifact.
I was, of course, as one does, I was reading a creationist blog before I came here. And this particular author was taking a lot of interest in breaking down your field into as a hoax, right? And he was talking about how interesting it was that every single reconstruction of Lucy that he could find and that I could find too, all had white sclera, the white of the eye, you know?
That's true. The white sclera is something that is ubiquitous in modern humans and really doesn't exist anywhere else among the primates. And we have no idea, therefore, when it came in. We've got no comparative base. But you're making a reconstruction, you have to make it with a white sclera or without a white sclera. Either way, you're taking a gamble. You've got a 50% chance of being right. Either way, but you've got to do something. You can't just leave the eyes out. You can't leave the ears off because you can't know how large they were. You know, there's all these details that actually have to be in a complete reconstruction, and the details that any member of the public would expect to be there, but that no scientist really wants to commit themselves to. But they have to.
I disagreed with most of the things this guy had to say. But, I mean, it would be different if I could find any of these things that didn't have white sclera, right?
That I don't understand. The logic there, I don't understand. We could quite just as easily put dark sclera. you know, in any of our reconstructions and have the same chance of being right or wrong as we have right now. The white sclera always go in because humans, all humans have them. And these creatures are in some way human. And so we'd rather on the side of making them, you know, visibly members of our group than excluding them from it. I mean, this is something, this is a subject that has, you know, been discussed quite a lot lately, but nobody really thought about it. People thought these are early humans. What kind of sclera do humans have? They have white sclera. So let's give them white sclera. And it was not even something I think that most people were thinking about until very recently. Huh. So that's what's usually been done. But no, I think people now reckon that the Australopiths probably did have dark sclera. But we can't know.
Yeah.
We cannot know.
Doesn't frustrate you?
No. No, because I'm not interested in dark sclera if it's not something we can talk about scientifically. We just like to talk about what we can. But when you're in the museum business, that's a different thing. The context is different. We're not pretending to do science here. We're pretending to do exhibition and help the past to come alive for our visitors. And we have to go beyond what we would strictly regard as science if we're going to do that.
I'm pretty convinced anything found that would indicate genders as a woman or a man or some sort of license that said that, an ID, would probably stir a lot of confusion in an archaeologist. Because I feel that in today's world, we're really heading towards a more androgynous society where there's not such a binary between woman or man, male, female. And as someone growing up in a society today, it's really become evident that these are socially constructed ideas. So 3 million years from now, I'm not sure that idea will hold. I'm not sure that blue will mean boy and pink will mean girl anymore. And I think really anything that indicates a difference in gender will have become obsolete and pretty confusing for someone 3 million years from now to understand.
People find things in the ground. They always have and they always will. Ancient gobi miners digging in the Gobi Desert stumbled on stone skeletons of beaked dinosaurs that walked on all fours, the Protoceratops. No one called them Protoceratops back then, but stories of these beasts filtered back west, and eventually the Greeks started writing of the griffins of the Gobi Desert, half lion, half eagle, fierce guardians of the desert's gold. And this is understandable, right? When we don't have all the information, we fall back on our existing worldview to fill in the gaps. The legend of the Cyclops was likely fueled by the massive skulls that were found around the Mediterranean that all have a hole right in the middle of them, a hole that looks perfect to fit this single eye. And next to the skulls, there were these giant ribs and femurs that seemed to confirm the theory. But as we know now, these bones all belong to dwarf elephants. And of course, there were the unicorn horns of the Middle Ages. They were said to have magical properties, and sailors sold these horns across Europe, profiting as long as their customers didn't grow suspicious of the sailors' frequent trips to the Arctic, or their frequent mutterings about some swimming animal called a narwhal. Of course, the modern world feels different, and we do know more now, but there are elements of the past that are unknowable by default. The taste of the wine that Jesus drank, the feeling of a dinosaur's skin, the question of whether or not the Big Bang had a smell to it. I live in the world assuming that these things are ephemeral,
And by that logic, it seems that that means that there are things about the present that are unknowable to archaeologists of the future. I just don't know what those things are. That Sunday in April, I looked at the two little creatures with the human eyes. They stood there, somewhat accurate versions of themselves, fleeing an unseen volcano and also walking through a museum, through ash and floor tile. They were 3 million years from home in a plexiglass time machine. And so I stayed with them there for what felt like a long time, but it wasn't.
I'm sitting here on a quiet night in Minneapolis, and I've got my dog's little paw wrapped around my thigh as he's stretching out now. I woke him up. He was chasing rabbits, I assume. And I think there will be no way to explain to people 3 million years from now the affection and the love that we have for our animals. Keep up the good work.
On this episode of Here Be Monsters, you heard voicemails from some listeners, including Tony Baker and Rachel Shapiro. If you ever have something that you want to say to us, just give us a call, 765-374-5263, or send a voice memo to us at hbmpodcast@gmail.com. Right now, we want to hear your questions. It's for an upcoming episode. So maybe you've got a question about how we make the show. Maybe you've got a question for someone we've talked to on an old episode. Maybe you want some relationship advice. Maybe you just can't fix your damn microwave and you need someone to tell you what to do. Just give us a call. 765-374-5263. Also, let me tell you about our new meat poster. It's the perfect addition for any home, office, or nursery. It's from our favorite designer, Adam Fine. He bought a steak and he carved our logo into it. It's a really beautiful print. It's just the right amount of shiny, just the right amount of red. Now here's the thing though, we only made a handful of them. Because seriously, who wants a picture of raw meat on their wall? I don't know. Maybe you do. If so, take a look. hbmpodcast.com/store. And also on our website, we have pictures of Ian Tattersall and the Laetoli figures. Again, we're at hbmpodcast.com. My name is Jeff Entman, and I produced this episode along with help from Bethany Denton. Here Be Monsters is a part of the Independent Producer Project from KCRW, where Nick White is our editor and Kristen Lepore is our manager. Music on this episode came from The Black Spot and The Other Stars. Thanks for listening. More episodes soon.
I live way out in the middle of the desert. My daughter downloaded podcasts for me of you guys about a year ago and can't get enough. I don't have the interweb or TV out here, but hey, my thing about what's unknowable to archaeologists of the future, you know, we have over 200 years of photographic evidence of our existence here. And ever since the creation of digital film, I think we're going to have a big blank spot. You know, we had all these hard copies of photographs, and I know I've taken literally thousands, and I don't think I've ever actually printed one of my digital pictures, and they're all gone in ones and zeros. But anyway, that's my little rant about what we're not going to find in the future. My name's Kevin Cannon, and I live out in the desert of Washington State. Thanks, you guys. You're doing great stuff.